It's the Ag Watcher Show. It's the Ag Watcher Show. It's the Ag Watcher Show.
Hi, I'm Angelina Charia, and I'm here on Ag Watchers and looking forward to our conversation today. I'm based in Melbourne.
Perfect. And Angeline didn't even get any notice of that introduction either. So that was perfect.
My poor organisation yet again. The one we did yesterday with Olympia was, she didn't quite catch it. So it was a little bit, wasn't as professional as yours, Angeline, because then that was my fault.
We'll have to listen to it to know that.
That's why we need to get a better assistant as opposed to
Fair enough.
Maybe get an AI assistant.
They're all the rage now.
So, Angeline, we'll get you to do a quick introduction into who you are, like 1 or 2 minutes. Like, who are you and what do you do in relation to agriculture and food? And then we'll get into testing you.
Excellent. Sounds good.
So tell us about you. Who are you?
Yeah. So, as I said, I'm Angeline. And you know what? I love food. I love food. I grew up on my grandparents' farm. In my early days in Fiji, would you believe? And it got me really interested in learning about how food comes and what it takes to grow food. And then I got really curious to go, well, how does it end up in that packet or on a plate in a restaurant and stuff like that? And so I ended up actually studying food science and technology, which then led me to this awesome career, of which I've done about 25 years worth and still going, looking at and working with companies that have been large, that have been medium, that have been small, and helping them to actually innovate for growth and growth in a way that is profitable, that is sustainable, so that you're not just doing one-off linear things, you're actually really nourishing the agriculture and the food ecosystem that we have.
And you've worked at a few kind of significant international manufacturers of food and also around the world a bit, yeah?
I have, yeah. So I've had the pleasure of working with companies and brands like Mars, and I actually spend a lot of my time based in Japan and China and Thailand for that role, and basically was actually designing food for pets. So little cats and dogs in Japan, and my goodness, you want that life for sure. And then I moved on from Mars to Fonterra, so in the world of dairy, really learning so much. I think we've got to learn from our Kiwi neighbours and the way that they do that. And of course, Fonterra influences the GDP of New Zealand. We all know that. But I had really fun there trying to innovate across all of the dairy category sectors, but also looking at ways to grow dairy out of the chiller. So how do you look at new white space and growth opportunities? I then went from there to Yum Brands, the famous Kentucky Fried Chicken and Pizza Hut back in the day and Taco Bell. And it was really different, you know, working with restaurants and really having a lot of freedom to be able to innovate and take things into restaurants. The challenge was always, you know, you'd come up with great food ideas and burger bills and things like that, but you had to really know how the 15-year-old in a very busy kitchen with drive-through beeping and honking away would be able to quickly assemble that in the time frame that it was needed. And then from there, I went to Mondelez, so the home of chocolate and candy and gum. And there I did something really crazy, which was I co-led and co-founded a world first food innovation center that was an investment by the Victorian government and Mondelez to really bring together industry, research, government, to collaborate for the bigger pie, if you will, rather than just the bottom line of everybody's P&L. And that was an amazing experience in my career, one that I think I still, you know, really talk about today. And that led me to, building a innovation center and then transferring it to Monash University. So I got to actually work in a university as well, which was coming from industry, I say we're a different planet. The university is a different planet and government's a different planet, right? So I've got lots of stories to share about that if we want to go down that path. And then, from there, I actually got asked to come into Simplot, the JR Simplot company, where I was looking after as exec director for innovation and growth, and that was essentially a remit to reset and transform the innovation and growth agenda, including the team that I was leading, and looked at both incremental innovation, so lots of new products, and across agri-food. And I think that's what I really enjoyed, was it actually took me back out of the factory, back onto the farms, and really looked at connecting that whole agri-food value chain and supply chain. And now I'm innovation game changer. So I'm kind of looking and exploring for my next exec role. And while I'm doing that, I serve on a number of boards, which is my way to give a lot of my skills and my experience to public and private and not-for-profit committees and boards. I speak a lot and do a number of sort of LinkedIn posts and things like that that you may be interested in, everything from agri-food export. How do we really sustain and create a circular space, as well as leadership? And I'm having fun. So I'm having fun kind of just exploring, spending some time, and helping lots of companies, whether they're small or they're big at the minute.
I reckon this podcast is going to go for about 5 hours, given the experience. But
Chris,
we might have to do it in
but
a
we
number of
do,
segments.
but we do have to move on. You've done your intro, but which is good, and I think you are right. If you do a job where you're having fun, you never work a day in your life, which is why I work so hard, and that's why my job is not fun at all, because I have to work with Matt. We have to run a psychological test on you, the same as we do with all of our guests. We have to make sure that you're capable of providing the correct answers. We have to be careful of making sure that you're compos mentis. So we're going to run the sixth sense test on you.
Oh, goodness.
We're going to give you a series of words or phrases, and you just give us the first thing that comes to mind. It could be as short as one word, or a short response. So Matt will keep a timer. We'll keep a count
A
of your
tally, yeah.
tally, and we will go ahead. So Matt, you first.
Food innovation.
My passion.
Crocs footwear.
I love shoes.
Haggis.
Oh dear, never tried it, but curious to try it.
Well, that's a fair answer.
Deep fried food.
Who doesn't love a good deep fried food? But in moderation.
Sustainable food manufacturing.
The only way to sustain the future.
Connecting food and agriculture.
My other passion, apart from my husband, this is the other passion to have as well.
So two passions. We started and then ended with passion.
Passion fruit.
Yeah.
So I want I'm sorry, I just took my phone on silent. That was unprofessional. Food innovation, yeah. The reason I asked that last question about sort of food and agriculture and the connection between the two is that we tend to have this sort of agricultural view of food, and then we've got this food view of food. And it seems that there's quite often a disconnect between like the farm gate and the end consumer. Do you think there's a way of sort of bridging that sort of a gap?
100%.
And how
There's
so?
a way to do it. And I tend to now use the term agri-food, like many do also around the world, where you can't have food without agriculture. And yes, while agriculture can go into fuel and other areas as well, but really agriculture from back when we can all remember it was there to create food, right? And sometimes I think along the way, we tend to forget. And I was one of those people when I was trained as a food product developer. I just saw agriculture as an input, something that would be procured, you'd have access to an ingredient or something that you would ask for, and it will just turn up, right? And very little did I think about how it came to be, what it took. Was this the best way that it could actually, be transported to me, to be given to me to create? And I do think in this country, I think, we can grow food to feed 75 million people. Fantastic. but a large chunk of that is commodity. And when I go and speak to farmers, I speak to manufacturers, I think what we're missing is an opportunity to truly connect that agri and food together. But also, the consumer out there actually wants to really know where my food comes from. And we have a job to do, I feel, every actor in that supply chain to be able to do that.
Does that mean that all kind of food sectors or manufacturers and even potentially producers need to look towards moving away from the commoditized side of the market and going down the pathway of kind of, labeled type products that are, appealing to multiple things than just the need for sustenance? Do you think that's the future, or is commodity side of the business going to always still be there?
I think there's room for both, right? All I'm saying is let's make sure that that food that we can grow to feed 75 million people actually has and is able to generate higher value along the supply chain, right? So whether you're converting it or creating it in something different actually gives you an offering. I mean, at the end of the day, doesn't matter which consumer, which demographic you talk to around the world, and this has been my experience, all of the consumers want healthy food, right? So health is really important.
Unless you're in Texas or Scotland.
Well, yes. They want convenient food because that nobody has time, right? So in whatever format, they want convenience and of course value. And value doesn't mean always price, but it's the value of the offer that you bring them, and then therefore they're willing to, pay the price that is actually commanded for it. So if we keep continuing down the commodity pathway, I see, and in my experience in 25 years, I think we will only unlock certain amount of value versus actually if we went and there's a higher value opportunity to do this, then I think we actually unlock much more offerings that we could do through convenient products, but also open the marketplace up in a better way. I mean, today sometimes we export our commodity only to buy it back in another ingredient format and then convert it here, right? So
I guess part of that, because we are like every commodity that we produce, let's look at wheat as an example, yeah? Yes, we're producing it as a commodity, but then it's getting exported as a commodity and then repurposed overseas. That's the only difference in terms of like innovating it into a product in Australia versus someone doing that in Indonesia or wherever else. But I guess one of the issues is labor force, and manufacturing in Australia is expensive. So how do we get around that, I guess?
Yeah, it's the old chestnut, right? So
Yeah.
whether it's a high cost of labor, a high cost of utilities, and therefore being able to do that. And I think, if anything, we all saw it through the pandemic when we were unable to get things through over the water, whether it was the pandemic, it was, then the war, and things like that. And I think it made actually everybody across the food value chain realize the sovereignty of local manufacturing, being able to do that. The other thing, from my perspective is, while we grow so much food and commodity, there's a lot of waste that's happening on the other side. 40% of food is wasted. So for a country like ours, where we are actually lucky, we're so fortunate to have food that we could feed, yet so many go hungry as well, right? So for me, the equation has never truly added up because we're still doing the things the same way. So if we actually went the other way, and yes, we could say, well, we'll never be a cheaper cost country just given our labor here, but then why don't we design higher value premium offerings as well, right? Which then can command the kind of prices that consumers will be willing to pay. And that may not only be in Australia, it's actually international markets that we can. And ultimately, you want scale, otherwise you're not generating the level of profit that is needed in this space.
So we talked about that sort of innovation of food probably on a macro level, yeah? But I wanted to delve in a little bit more, I guess, at a micro level on food innovation. So you worked for Simplot. So Matt and I do a lot of work with Simplot, and so we visited their offices in Melbourne a lot of times. And I remember seeing the blind taste test rooms and the big kitchens, and I remember going for meetings there and getting to test new foods whilst we were having our lunch and whatnot. So I find food innovation quite interesting. And funnily enough, I was on Twitter 5 minutes before here discussing a food innovation. It was Twisties. You know, the little...
I do.
Corn chips. But they've made a special Twisties now that are cinnamon donut flavored Twisties.
I'm not sure if that's innovation or some kind of a crime against humanity.
I quite like them. Like, they're quite nice when you go to the cinema because they're just like a dry, cold cinnamon donut. And they're always cheap. They're always discounted half. They're always like 50 cents a packet instead of $4 a packet. But how does that come about, creating a product? I know you don't know the specific intricacies of that particular product, but how does it come about creating a new food innovation?
Yeah, it's a great question, right? And I can certainly share examples of how you bring a product together. And let me probably say first, it takes both the science side as well as the creative and the art side. So I'll always say food innovation is the bringing together of the science and the art together. So if you're creating a new product, if you had a brand, then obviously you'd have some guidelines, some, you know, must-dos that the brand needs to stand for. So whether it's, you know, natural ingredients and things like that, you would then start to actually look at the category that you're operating in. So say if you're looking at creating the next new tomato sauce, how would you go about doing it? You'll understand, look at the category, which is essentially the shelf in the supermarket, or it's online, or it's out of home. You'd look at all of that space and go, okay, what's here that is maybe missing, that is a white space? Or is there a way to create something that is actually going to bring new users in, or actually take users from existing brands within the category? So you'd go about actually understanding the consumer and the marketplace in terms of, you know, what consumers want. If you're targeting a specific demographic, say it's the Gen Zs, you know, what do they want in a tomato sauce that's different to what Ys or the Xs might want or the boomers might want? So you could go very specific. You would then take a lot of those insights and basically start to pull them together. What do you know today? What don't you know? Where are the gaps? And you'd actually bring a diverse group of people around to do some ideation. So you would ideate, and you could then make those ideas as expansive as you wanted, or you could actually constrain them to say, you know, we have a factory that has this line that has XYZ capacity, that has this packaging format, and we have a source of tomatoes that can only be this variety. So you could do that as well if those factors were known. And then those ideas are then usually taken, and if you're great at doing this and you're customer and consumer centric, you may actually speak to your customer, which is the people that you may sell the product to eventually, and get some of their input and their feedback early in the process. And this way you actually de-risk your idea, and it's really important, and I'll mention why later. And then the other thing is you probably go and test it with the right consumer or the target market. And some companies do that. You know, the old way was through focus groups and panel, like the sensory that you would have attended at Simplon, you know, those blind tasting or known testing. Or you can use, you know, digital now. You have access to so many consumers online so quickly. You can get really live, very quick feedback. So you can really reduce your time, if you will, to development. And that's certainly one of the key metrics in food innovation. And then after that, if the idea is successful, it scores really, really well, then it becomes basically a brief that you put together, and the product development and the marketing teams and the supply chain teams then go about in a cross-functional way to bring that product to life through the kitchen, through the pilot plant, and then through to a factory. And along the way, you keep testing it in a sensory booth perspective, that as one example, if you wanted to, just to make sure that it still tastes great and it delivers to the claims that you're trying to make. Obviously, you would make sure your food is safe, so you're doing all your microbiological testing, your chemical testing, your nutrition testing, and then you actually have a product. So you're creating both not just what's inside. So if it's the source product itself, but you're actually thinking also of the packaging right up front rather than kind of going, hang on, I've created this source, let's just put it in what we have. And some companies do that as well, but I'm a huge believer in, being product centric, as a holistic, so product and packaging together as well. Once that I'll drop, I'm sorry, is 9 out of 10 products fail in the first 12 months of launch.
Like cinnamon donut flavor twisties.
Right. And it's probably never going to be there forever.
Because I find it really fascinating, like food innovation. Like obviously that's a very professional scientific approach to it. But then I look at Scotland, right? So I'm gonna go on a bit of a tangent here, yeah? Like Scottish people are very well known for economics, we're known for fashion, comedy, music. So a lot of things we're well known for. But one of the things we're very no well known for is innovation. We've had a lot of inventions, more patents per head of population than anywhere else in the world. You can fact check that. Well, don't fact check that because it's probably made that up. But one of the things we are great at innovating is food products. And
Deep frying everything you can get your hands on isn't necessarily an innovation.
no,
There
but it.
was a deep fried Mars bar at one stage. I remember I
That's
was
right.
working at Mars at back then.
And so you've got the deep fried Mars bar. So that involved no focus groups. It just involved, somebody. It was like, I guess it was like, I don't want to say it. It's like the Greeks. It was like the ancient Greeks, the sort of Eureka moment. That was just Jimmy and his fish and chip shop in Aberdeen who'd come up with that off the going back. So there's one invention. But if you look at Scottish food on Instagram, you will just see innovation after innovation. And that's where I think there needs to be a trade delegation from Australia. Because I'm going to say this, fish and chip shops in Australia are terrible. You can't even get a deep fried pizza. So this is where Scottish innovation. But
Or what's that thing called the Munchie Box? That's full of all this,
Munchie
everything
box.
deep fried you can find,
But you know what else you can get, which I still haven't been able to find it yet. I keep going on trips to Scotland, but I haven't actually managed to get one. It's a pork sausage, so like a foot long pork sausage. Then like doner meat of the
Kebab
spit,
mate. Kebab
kebab
mate,
meat,
yeah.
yeah. Like a thin layer of that, so like a big long strand wrapped around a sausage, and then battered, and then fried. Like that is food innovation. Like who thought of that? And so these are the kind of people we actually want to be bringing to like Simplot and Mondelez and actually harnessing their innovative capacity. Because imagine if they were in that vault. But my actual point was, I had a sensible point to that conversation. Crisps. Going back to those donut crisps, yeah?
Or chips in this in Australian
Yeah, whatever.
language.
So when you go back to cold chips or crisps, Australia is pretty poor as well. Like there's not the variety you get in the UK.
The flavors that we go on
The
about.
flavors, yeah. What I quite like about Walkers, which is like the big crisp company in the UK, our equivalent of Lay's. I think they actually might own Lay's. On a yearly basis, what they do is they actually go out to the marketplace, to the consumer, and get them to come up with the idea for flavors. And then it gets voted on by the people. And then they'll run a sort of a promotion
Isn't
on.
that how that kind of stuff when you go the just the public, that's how you end up with boats that are called Boaty McBoatface. All right. That's where that finishes. You get these silly ideas of some random flavors that no one's gonna eat, like cinnamon donut flavored
But my main,
twisties.
I guess my main point is like, from a food innovator and somebody who's worked in the food industry, why is food in Australia doesn't have, why do they not have as many crisp varieties or as many deep fried products? Like we don't even have, and this again, it's another tangent. You go to a fish and chip shop, you've got tartar sauce, tomato sauce, gravy. Why don't we have curry sauce
In the fish and chip shops,
in the fish and
you
chip?
could set up your own. Maybe it's
There is
the
only one.
market.
There is one in St Kilda in Melbourne that does curry sauce, but it's a British style fish and chip shop.
But maybe the market just isn't here in Australia for it. So
Just
then,
so the market's not matured enough yet for it.
well, that they've got more mature flavors than they've gone beyond.
Well, less mature taste buds compared to the British.
Or that's opportunity to come. So maybe curry sauce could be the next new innovation that we see in lots of fish and chip shops around Australia because people are hearing this conversation, right? And I do think you hit a point is so not always, and many companies, and I certainly have done this, is where you would co-create. You'd co-create with your customer or your consumer. So, a great example of that was when I was at Mondelez, we did Vegemite Cadbury. Anyone remember that? And so put Vegemite into Cadbury Dairy Milk, right? And we knew going in it would be 50-50. There will be a polarization on it. But guess what? It had a huge impact. There was lots of conversation and PR, and the whole halo spread across all of the rest of the Cadbury Dairy Milk.
So I haven't actually tried Vegemite at all.
Oh, wow.
I
You've been
smell.
here for what, 15 years or something, haven't you?
Yeah.
Come on, Matt. You need to get him a jar and get it on his toast
Well,
tomorrow.
Andrew can try Vegemite and Angelina will try Haggis.
So I've smelt it, but I'm guessing
It's like Marmite.
it's a Marmite. It's a salty product, yeah.
Yes,
So really,
salty.
Vegemite and chocolate is just going to be like salted
Salted
chocolate.
caramel or chocolate. Yeah,
Yeah.
but
So
there
it's
was 50% of the consumers out there loved it. And the other 50 didn't like it, right? So again, at the end of the day,
but
it
is it
comes
is it
back to what you love and what you don't. And the question is, if you can scale it and you can make some money out of it, then there's business.
So I guess
Otherwise.
like Vegemite is like Marmite, yeah?
Yeah, not too
It's
different.
the same product, pretty much. But the slogan for Marmite in the UK was, you either love it or you hate it. So there you go, there's your 50%. So it's a scientific evidence that the Marmite slogan was correct.
Well, what I wanted to ask you about food innovation more broadly, because you said at the outset on the sixth sense, passion, you just referred to food innovation as your passion. But does, and you described before when Andrew asked you about the product, taking a product to that consumer end is part of food innovation. Is that the only, is that generally food innovation more broadly? Is that what it means? Or does food innovation encompass more than what you do in that kind of, targeting a new product in that sense that you described? Can it be also including an innovative change to the raw ingredient, like a GM modification? Does that fall into also food innovation, or is that a different segment of the supply chain?
No, absolutely. It's anything all the way from the start to the end of the chain, right? That's how I see it. Now, people will define it differently as well. But for me, I think, one of the big things when we talk about innovation, and lots of people talk about innovation, and some have a view that it's the big, sexy stuff. For me, it's actually about any change that creates value. And that value could be a return on that investment. It could be a value from a process in the factory. It could be on-farm productivity, for instance. It could be further down, looking at how do you get directly to the consumer, with your finished product. So all of that are examples of innovation. And sometimes, ultimately, we're all in the business of creating wonderful food and drink products at the end of the day. So if you can look at across the holistic, and sometimes, when you're creating a new product, it's never in isolation. So you've got to look across the chain. You've got to look at, finding the best ingredient, ensuring that you could have a great story to tell. These days now you're looking at your ESG metrics as well. So those things are really important. And then what happens to the end product in terms of if it's wasted, if it's recycled, could any of the components from a packaging point of view be recycled and reused as well? So I think really bringing that circularity and that thought is going to be really important. Otherwise, we'll end up creating linear products. I mean, the last time you walked down a supermarket, let's take Coles, right? 44,000 storekeeping unit SKUs in there. That's a lot of products. There's a lot of choice there.
And very few British products is all I'm going to say.
They haven't created the British Isle yet, maybe. That's probably what.
No,
Well,
the
they've.
international aisle. Maybe this
Well,
demand's not there. The demand's not there.
they have a British, they have an international meter. So they have 1 meter of shelf space, which is international, which is generally the British section, combined with Polish and South African. But they've got 4 meters of Mexican or Mexicali food or Tex-Mex food. So I'm just saying, like, we just have forgotten about people. I actually had a serious question. I
Okay.
forgot it, so I'm going to go to my second question. Food innovation, you mentioned there about that actually the delivery of food innovation. I actually think the biggest food innovation of the last 10 years has been things like HelloFresh. Because that is a huge, like I know so many people that use HelloFresh or their alternatives. And I think that's, what do you think about that? Because I think that's quite an interesting sort of model. And it's sort of puts the cooking, it makes ready meals, but puts the cooking back on the person, the individual
Is
for,
that food information? Is that food information, or is that just?
well, it is food, it's food delivery information, innovation.
Yeah.
Like, I don't, have you seen them, Matt?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about, but
Yeah,
I
no,
just.
but have you actually seen a packet of them, like a box?
Oh, no.
Well,
No.
you know what you're talking about them, mate. So let me explain. So it comes with like all the bits you need, yeah? So like you'll get, like say, pork quesadillas, yeah? It'll come with the pork for you to cook. Then it'll come with all the spices. Then it'll come with an avocado and onion. And then it'll come with like a laminated sheet of how to cook it bit by bit. And it's just like one meal. So it's for people who are, don't really know what they want to eat. So you just order five meals and they'll come to you.
Would that classify? I guess from your explanation before, Angelina, about anything that brings value into the sector is an innovation, then that would classify, wouldn't it, as a food innovation?
Absolutely. And you know what you're doing there through the meal kits and those boxes is you're actually making it convenient for the consumer. You know, all of us only probably at most have 14 recipes that we probably replay all the time, right? And so what, you know, people like HelloFresh have really done is given you a plethora of choice and made it really, really simple. The other thing I like about that is it's really convenient. Everything comes already for you. You probably just need a couple of staples in your pantry, which most of us would have. You're not wasting anything. So, you know, if you've gone out and bought, say, to use on the quesadillas, you know, some carrots or something, and it's been in the fridge for 2 weeks or something like that, well, it's probably lost a lot of its quality attributes, right? So here you are, you're getting the right fresh carrot as well. So I think it does tick a fair few things, and definitely I think wastage of food, it addresses that pain point, which some consumers may or may not realize it, but at the end of the day, it's convenience. You're getting to try something different, you're pleasing all the family, and you can cook it for one, two, four, or many in that space as well. Yeah, and I've used it too, Andrew. Matt, you need to probably try it and
No, my no.
I haven't actually used it because I like to cook everything from scratch.
Yeah.
But and
And
what
I've
why
and
do you
we
think that's not
do.
from scratch?
Because I just like to get, I just eat black pudding every day and haggis. So it doesn't take much for me to cook it. Just one potato, one haggis, one glass of whiskey. And that's me. That's why
And
I'm
was the dessert the deep fried Mars bar?
I'll tell you what, I've very rarely had a deep fried Mars bar, and I think I've had one in Scotland, and I've had multiple ones in Australia because Australian chip shops more readily sell them than Scottish ones.
Well, you were saying before this during fish and chip shops are no good, and now you're saying you've had more deep fried Mars bars here than you've had over there. You
Well,
can't have it both. You can't have it both ways. You can't be critical of your newfound country.
I've got no choice. I can't just bloody fly 28,000 kilometers to get, you know, a sausage supper or a deep fried pizza. I take what I'm given.
Could get Auntie Julie to pack you up a box of deep fried Mars bars or par fried, and then fry
If
them a bit more when you
you
get
if
when
like,
you.
as another tangent, before I ask the serious question that I had, if you're looking for a really good dessert that's simple to make and tastes beautiful, is Kranichen, which is whipped cream with toasted oats and whiskey and honey, along with shortbread and raspberries. And it is beautiful. You've had it, Matt.
I don't think I have had that one. I've had it in its individual form, but you know, like just the whiskey or
And
just the oats or just
and
the
I and I
whipped
put
cream.
and I put some crushed meringue inside it as well, just to add an extra sweet element. Actually, I had a
And is
serious
that
quick.
a Scottish origin as well, are you?
I only eat Scottish food.
Wow.
And
Amazing.
Cullen skink, which sounds disgusting, but it's just fish soup. and it's
okay.
and it's gluten free. So my
I've got a serious one as well. So I want to start with, because you mentioned at the outset too about the 25-year career you've had in a whole lot of different countries, and actually in different food manufacturers of quite different types, right? What would you say, look, because you said in the outset there were quite some differences when you jumped from job to job, but were there also things that stuck out as similarities across both, say, consumers in different countries, but also in that manufacturing side, even though you were going from, you know, the sweets and chocolates to a Simplot to, you know, different kind of product streams, what were the big differences that stood out, and what were the big similarities, if there were any, when you made all those different changes?
Yeah, I think the big differences working in different markets and different cultures is just probably like the Scottish example before. You know, different consumers have different taste profiles and prefer things differently, right? So, for instance, chocolate in Japan, you know, cannot be as sweet as what it is in for the Australian palate. So you always have to tailor it to that. But largely, I would say most consumers globally, you know, people like familiar differences. So probably 80% of it is familiar in a format, in a profile, or whatever you're having it in. And it's the tweak that you're doing to really customize it for that demographic, for that market. So for me, that's probably been always. But, you know, for me, always you start and end with the consumer along that chain. You know, it's not like what you as a product person wants, or, you know, what a marketing person says or a salesperson says. It needs to be what the consumer, and those are the ones that will actually be the winning products. Otherwise, there's a high rate of failure in this space as well. I think the other thing, you know, that is probably familiar is, until most recently, as I mentioned before, you know, it's product. Ingredients are seen as inputs, right? They're inputs, so it's what you can get and then you create. And I think more and more now companies are evolving and really looking at what is available, what is actually better for the planet, better for us from a health perspective, and really creating then the products as well. And I think that is also common a little bit across the world as well, because ultimately, you know, for those who can afford, we're probably eating way too much. And for those who can't, well, you know, they actually can't get the nutrition that is needed as well.
Is that when you said about the different distinctive kind of flavor profiles that broad groups, like you said, Japanese don't have as sweet a chocolate as what we do in Australia, with kind of growing globalization and, you know, mingling of culture and stuff, and in countries like Australia that are, you know, are lucky enough to have.
Are you going to suggest that maybe Australians will get a taste for haggis and black pudding?
No. What I was going to ask is that, say, over the last 20 years or so, with that kind of, you know, more travel, more intermingling, more globalization, for those at least in, you know, a country like Australia that has quite a big and varied different groups of ethnic groups that have come through in waves. So we've got lots of different food types we can get here, and, you know, I've always grown up here eating a whole lot of different food varieties. Does that mean that for those type of consumers, their palate has changed? Like, is there a global palate as well for a subset of people?
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're probably one of the most travelled, you know, nations around the world, right? If you think about it, just because we're so far, and we love that, and we have all of the foods available, which we're so blessed about. I don't know if there's a global palate. Maybe there is for some, but there's certainly more openness to try different things. There's more openness to experience different cuisines and different flavours as well. And I think, you know, you know, even if you look at Australia, right? I mean, do you remember back in, you know, certainly, you know, when I was in like primary school in the mid 80s, right? And I'd remember the one Chinese restaurant in the town, right? And yeah,
sweet,
guaranteed
sweet, sweet
like
and sour pork.
Yeah, lemon chicken, you know, sweet and sour pork, you know, beef and black bean, right? And now you look at Chinese food in our country in terms of regionality, Sichuan, you know, what you might want to season and things like that as well. So even our own perception of what we thought and we were introduced to is very, very different moving forward. So I think, you know, you're probably bang on. I think, you know, there might be a global palate kind of, you know, acceptability and forming now as people get to experience more of this as well. And
It's
we
it.
are very fortunate, I think, and I've traveled all over the world and always love coming back because, you know, we get all of the foods here and probably as good as what you would get back in the local places as well.
It's uh, du it's dumplings.
Dumplings.
That's
Is
the
that
answer.
the
That is the global food. Like, which nation doesn't have its own version of dumplings? Which culture doesn't have its own version of dumplings? There's dumplings, pierogi, momos, gyoza, dumplings in China. There's Indian dumplings. There's British dumplings. Italian
What about Scottish?
dumplings.
Is it Scottish dumplings yet?
It's very different.
I think they're deep fried.
Deep fried.
What you mentioned about traveling a bit, and I wanted to ask, so someone that's an expert in that whole food space, right? And you've had a long career in that.
Oh, what is the best cuisine in the world, and what
that's
is the worst cuisine?
No, I'm going to ask if you had to be limited
if you had to ban one cultural cuisine.
Well, you can ask that. I'm going to ask the more positive question because you're the dour Scotsman that always goes straight to the negative. I'll go the positive one first. You go the negative.
I'm just trying to get Angeline cancelled.
Yeah. If you had to only choose, say, two or three cuisines that you could only eat for the rest of your life, what would be the top, say, three you'd pick in terms of, you know, traditional cuisine?
That's really good.
Because
Well,
this is
look,
going to, this is
I'm
because
of
you're an expert,
Indian
you're an expert.
heritage, so I have to pick Indian food. It's probably been the most that I've eaten, and very formative, obviously. But you know, I always said if I had one of those, and not that I'm imagining myself in one of those orange suits or anything like that, but my last meal that I would call up would be definitely Japanese, and it would be sashimi. You know,
Oh,
like
yes.
A grade, you know, the stuff that I've tasted at 3 a.m. from Tsukiji Market in Tokyo and had, you know, early breakfast of sashimi has been by far the experience that I still taste today.
Yeah, I would go with that.
That'd be your two, just Japanese and Indian. I agree with Japanese. That'd be my top. And I reckon Middle Eastern, whether it's Lebanese or some kind of Middle Eastern combination, I'd go for. And I think
Mine would be
if I
Middle Eastern or some sort of seafood, like Polynesian or Japanese, like sashimi
Mm.
type would be it.
If I could have a third, it'd be a toss-up between Spanish or French.
I do like Spanish. Okay, here's the question. I'll point this to
No, I
both.
know where you're going.
Now I've changed it,
All right.
and it can go to both of you. What is the most overrated cuisine in the world?
I know what you're going to say. I know your answer to this
You know
one.
my answer. You know.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. All right, let Angeline go
All
first.
right. I reckon. And just from probably this conversation, I think it's Scottish.
It's
Overrated.
overrated.
Overrated, right?
Overrated,
All right.
right?
And we're not going to get Angeline cancelled
Good.
other than from this podcast. Well,
I'm not.
you
I'm
know, my
not.
eyes
I'm
were
not.
open to a number of things today, but I was like, really?
I'm not gonna. I'm not gonna talk anymore.
Yeah, I'm.
Enjoy the rest of the podcast, Matt.
Yeah, I'm going to say. And it's not because I quite like spicy food, but sometimes spicy food doesn't like me. I think that's just a hereditary condition I have. So I'd probably say overrated. I'd say Thai, I reckon. You know,
Okay.
yeah, it's quite common, and you know, a lot of people go for Thai, but it's yeah, I don't know. I like it, but I don't think it's as good as what it's made out to be.
Italian.
Yeah.
Italian. Like I said this the other day and somebody got annoyed by it. I feel that Italian is either really good. And I think we've been to a good Italian place,
Yeah,
Matt. And
we've been a couple.
it's either really, really good. Or it is just might as well be microwaved meals. Like I just most Italian places are just pedestrian at best. And I feel that it's largely a lot of it is quite flavorless. And I just don't like Italian food. I think I've experienced Italian food. Maybe I eat out a lot, Italian food, handful of times that I've thought, well, that was really nice and I'd go back there. But Italian
It
food.
might just be the Italian places you're frequenting. If it's a highly kind of commercial type touristy place on Lygon Street or something, then it's going to be pretty run of the mill.
I'm well traveled, Matthew, and all I can say is that Italian food is not my first call. I mean, it's good. It's quick, easy, and cheap to put together. It's just simple ingredients and basic in taste and texture.
Well, spag bol is one of those recipes in that 14 that I mentioned
It's
in
a go-to,
Australia.
isn't it? It's a pretty. It's one of the more
Staple.
common dishes in Australia. I think it's probably. I seem to remember there was a survey once saying what's the national dish of Australia, and I think spag bol won it.
Really?
I think
Wow.
so. I seem to think that I might be. Maybe I've just dreamt.
I
Maybe
think
I dreamt it.
chicken korma was the one for the UK. I think so.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't anything. I'm pretty sure spag bol was the one everyone voted as their go-to.
Okay, so
Now,
I do have a question actually on a topic of food innovation, and we're talking about like going back to that sort of cinnamon
the
twisties, yeah?
twisties.
That's and that type of innovation, like new type of product or changed product. What is the best product that you've ever seen? Because you must look at a lot of products and think that's a good product, that's a bad product. What is the best one you've seen in your career, whether it's yours or whether it's another company's, and what's the worst one?
Oh, it's so hard to pick that. It's like picking
Your favorite children.
or your favorite food. I think if I look across, probably one of the big game changers that I've seen is the leafy salads, the fresh cuts in the bags. Do you buy that, or do you still buy a head of lettuce and chop it?
I'm Scottish. I don't know what you're talking about.
He doesn't eat anything green.
Oh, right, okay, wrong color.
That's a lie, Matthew.
But you know, that
I
is
like
such a
green curries.
right. Okay, well, a little bit close in
And
the
green sriracha.
same color though.
I grow a lot of our own food here, so we tend to take our salad from the garden.
Right. Okay. Well, those do come from the garden. They just come in a much more convenient way where you open a pack and toss it in a bowl, right? So I remember actually when that came, and the UK has been very mature in that, as was the US
As
before it came here.
expected.
And there was almost this big head shaking around. Oh my goodness, you know, you can buy a head of lettuce for whatever it was, 50 cents back then. You know, why would you go and pay $4 for this fresh cut bag? And you know, there was a lot of uproar around it. But guess what? It's actually a really big category in terms of, again, offering convenient, healthy value products that consumers love. So I think, you know, that kind of space that has really created that convenience factor, and being able to give you more of the good stuff, in that space is great. Is
The
there
one we do buy that's similar to that, it's a regular one, is the pre-cut
yeah,
coleslaw
so all
stuff.
of those,
So
right? Yeah.
So that's one, because it's a nuisance to cut up the coleslaw in such a fine way. So that
You're
one,
so lazy, man.
there you
No,
go.
well, that's, you know,
Convenient. Convenient.
and also where I am, the cabbage fly
Matt,
moth is it's terrible. So
you've got so much
yeah.
time on your hands, Matt. You don't need convenience. You work from home.
I don't have a product that I think. I mean, there have been a few.
Okay,
The bad,
presumably the bad
it's
ones never saw the light of day. So there'd be a whole swag of bad ones that, like,
no, but
eventually,
yeah,
people.
and equally, you know, I've had a great career of launching more than 1,200 of what I would call successful products, right? But it's double that of failure, right? Whether they failed before the idea stage, at the
So
idea stage.
if you ranked the 1,200, what would be 1,200th?
Oh yeah, probably the last one worked on.
I just remember, like, in the night, I remember like looking at like some website of like failed foods where it just didn't work. And like, things that spring to mind are when VB changed their recipe.
Yeah, that was a disaster.
That was a disaster. And Pepsi or Coke in the 1990s made a clear version.
Oh yeah, Clear Pepsi, that's an
Clear Pepsi.
infamous failure story, but a good lesson learned, right? As well, on that now.
Iron Brew. Iron Brew, I don't know if you know what Iron Brew is.
Scottish
It's a
soft
Scottish
drink.
soft drink. So one of the claims to fame about Scotland is that it's the only country in the world where Coca-Cola actively market where Coca-Cola is not the number one drank soft drink. And so Iron Brew outsells Coca-Cola.
Is it like a Fanta? I don't think I've had Iron Brew. Is it like a Fanta or something or what?
No.
So what's it taste like? And don't say it tastes like Iron Brew.
Tastes Iron Brew. No, the Iron Brew actually put out adverts because nobody can actually describe it properly. Everyone has a different taste of it, but it is very good for hangovers. And
That's why it's the most number one consumed soft drink in Scotland.
it's got a funny story, actually. I've got a tangent here. And this is a food innovation tangent for you. This is something you can use in a presentation. So in the Victorian era, Glasgow has a huge railway station, two huge railway stations. Obviously wrought iron, beautiful, but really high. And so they're putting these together, and it took a couple of years to build. So all these people are up high. But in those days, all these welders and stuff would go to the pub and have a couple of pints with their lunch. And then they'd come back and go up on top of these railings and start welding. This was pre-health and safety. Then they would slip off and kill themselves. And this was across building sites, across when Britain was industrializing. In Scotland, this was a huge thing where people would go for a few pints, fall off.
I thought you were going to say they'd begin urinating from up on top of the thing because they couldn't be bothered going back to the
No,
ground floor to the toilets.
they fall off and die.
They were more civil than that, Matt.
But anyway, so a pharmacist created this product, which was a carbonate soft drink, and then started encouraging workers at this building site to drink it. Then it just spread. So they
So
were
that's where it
the
came.
no,
That's
it's
where
a
it came from.
true story where it came
Oh,
from.
okay. Wow.
But
Right.
so it was A.G. Barr's, the chemist. Anyway,
Is that why it's called Iron Brew? Because it was iron workers or fabricators and whatever that were drinking it. Oh, okay.
made from,
Righty-o.
made from girders, which is an iron bar.
Yeah.
But my point actually was that was a really long-winded of saying that Iron Brew changed their recipe recently to meet the requirements of the sugar tax in the UK, and now it tastes terrible. And so that has caused their sales to slump because it just doesn't taste as nice without the full fat sugar. So I guess that's an interesting story of like how you've changing to meet government demands. It could still be full fat sugar, but it would cost a lot more. And they
You
do.
mentioned that HLN can use it in a presentation, and you guys are going to be presenting together next month.
Yeah, I think it'll be a good conversation over our panel, Andrew.
Exactly. So, well, we're talking about disruption, and that is a disruptor is government intervention in sugar markets. But my actual question was of tangential to that point is if we look at things that you mentioned ESG, and you mentioned like consumer wants and consumer demands. Consumer wants organic. Consumer wants regenerative agriculture, cage free. Da da da. All these sort of, I guess, taglines that go across products. Do you think that's still going to be the case in a high inflationary period with a cost of living crisis? Or do you think they still want demand that but want it cheaper?
It's a really good question. I think post pandemic, it's now become sustainability and sustainability credentials have become table stakes, right? So it's not even that you can charge more for it. It's almost this demand, and it's been really driven probably by the Gen Zs, if you will, the millennial generation, more so
Sorry, guys. Sorry, guys.
than the X's and the boomers, perhaps, right? I'm sure some of us fall into that today, right? A Z.
Yeah, I'm a millennial. Yep. So,
Andrew refers to me as a
oh,
boomer, but I'm not quite.
guess what I had on the weekend? As it's completely sort of unrelated. Guess what I had on the weekend? I had a turmeric latte,
Well, there you go.
it was really nice. It was too big. I got a small. If they had a piccolo version of it, it would be beautiful. It's just too much for
What do
me.
you mean? There goes all our
But
agricultural
great
farming
health
listeners.
benefits for you, you
It
know.
was milk. It
Yeah, I
was
had turmeric, yes,
anti-inflammatory.
wasn't it? Yeah, it's meant to be.
Yeah. So I do I think it'll be a watch and go. In my experience, whenever we do see inflationary and people go, the masses go to their budget. That's all they can afford. And I think you're hearing several things in Australia, which is really sad in terms of how much people are looking for handouts through people like Food Bank and Sick and Bite now as well, right? So it is tough out there. There's people who are skipping meals to some extent as well, given how much they can afford to pay. So ultimately, food is a spend. It's something that, everybody needs to eat, so you're going to have to spend it. But there's so many competing things now, right? If you have your streaming services, well, are you going to put it to that, or are you going to put it to food? And when I go shopping, I certainly do look at other people's trolleys and baskets all the time because I'm so curious. And I am seeing a lot of own branded, supermarket branded products, a lot of, buy on special, and consumers are shopping. They're not loyal to any chain. They're shopping around to find the best value. And for value for them is not necessarily price, right? There's lots of things that come into value, and I think that will be voted. But I do feel like it's probably not the same sentiment that was po pre-pandemic versus post, because I think we're a lot more, we've gone through that experience. We know what it takes to not have food on the shelf, right? Be it we went a little bit crazy doing that. I think all of that is now becoming a lot more conscious and front and center of consumers' minds. So I do think, it's a factor in decisions of what they purchase.
Do you think, from an industry perspective in that food space, and I guess you could include the export side of the market too, in terms of the agricultural product that are food based that get exported, do you think the Australian sector focuses too much on the local consumer, given that most of our kind of big volume product actually is exported in that food space as an ag commodity? Should the sector be conscious also of the end consumer in market overseas, in terms of how we kind of what we focus upon in terms of the supply chain, and what we kind of pay attention to, whether it's animal welfare standards or environmental sustainability or triple bottom line type stuff? Are we conscious as an industry that most of our product actually ends up going overseas to a whole different consumer to the local person?
I think we're very aware, and when I work with companies and speak to them around the export opportunities, many, many companies want to do that, right? And are doing that. They've learned a lot of lessons, right? They've learned lessons like, how do you tailor the food to the end user and that consumer, the taste piece that we were talking about. And then there's trade barriers, there's regulatory pieces to overcome as well. So to do that it's not like it's not as easy, but there are also a number of great support and resources around at our local, state, and federal government bodies that are available to organizations to do that. I think one of the big challenges in Australia is, why don't companies do more of that? Sometimes what I'm hearing play back to me, it's just a hassle. It's a hassle to go and do this, to do that, and X, Y, Z, right? And so what happens is, if you look at the Australian food opportunities and the choices that we have, to the conversation we're having before, comparing to a market like UK, where you have so much more choice, is you're not able to then grow and scale to a limitless opportunity if you had always your eyes on something you're creating that could actually be applied into an overseas market with a little tweak and customization. And so what that means is also that we're not able to then invest in capital here as much, and therefore, because we're not able to scale, because we're only going to be, what, 30 million people, sort of. And you need more than that to scale, right? So most big brands that you The organizations I've worked in, they have products that are in multiple markets, and that's how you scale profitably and sustainably at the end of the
Does
day.
that then, from an Australian, like I'm talking broad brush kind of macro here, does that the fact that we have that smaller 30, not quite 30 million population, does that then mean by nature, without a big domestic market in its own right, like say the US or the UK or Europe or elsewhere, that we are almost always going to be locked into the commodity side a lot of the time, that we have to then send the commodity overseas to be manufactured for the target market that's overseas as an end consumer? Because our country here is such a small population, we've only got a limited kind of consumer capacity here because of the lack of numbers of citizens.
Yeah, and it's a really great perspective, and that's probably why, maybe one of the reasons we find ourselves where we are over the years, right, to get to this. But I also believe if it's, if we could convert that ourselves and we could make the financials, the economies of scale work, then it would mean that we would become a net exporter of products. You look at countries like Canada who do this really, really well, or even someone like a Singapore who's starting to really do that when they don't really have any land to farm and things like that. So I think there's choices, there's strategic choices that you can make and really be quite visionary about this. I think one of the challenges is sometimes we get so short-termism that we don't actually look for the bigger piece, right? And connecting that whole agri-food chain is so critical in doing that, to enable to do that. And one of the areas where I speak a lot on is actually with growers and farmers and sharing with them a thought on, so you've all heard farm to fork. What if we went fork to farm? What would the opportunities look like then? So for instance, I want, one of the big areas of growth I talked about was health, right? Every consumer will always look at health. So for instance, if you were able to eat broccoli with vitamin A, for instance, that was already in, but it came naturally in a broccoli that was grown in a field rather than adding it in the process, for instance, and it went through, wouldn't that be something that you're actually then as a grower and a farmer creating high value product straight away? And
So
therefore there's a
that's like
demand for it.
a GM modification
No, it
broccoli
doesn't have
type
to be
thing,
a
or is it?
GM modification. It can be a natural way to be able to do that, right? So
Selectively bred for higher whatever,
it
yeah.
could be, yeah. So all of that, I mean, there's science and technology already there, right? But the view is actually how do you change the perspective of going, how do I actually create more consumer enabled and things that consumers are after, as opposed to I just grow carrots and off it goes. And by the way, then you're with all the other carrot growers and you're running a price war between suppliers and things like that.
So next month, you're at the Future Ag Expo. You're on two. I'm only in one panel. Oh, we're doing a presentation as well, Matt. What are the panels you're on? You're on a panel with me on what are we doing? What are we talking about?
Isn't it to do with some kind of disruption
Just
or global conflicts or
building.
something?
We're
Building
building
was.
resilience in the face of geopolitical disruption.
That's it. Yeah.
What are you going to talk about, just so I can?
I was going to ask you.
So
Aren't
Andrew
you
can
the panel moderator?
Andrew can steal all your ideas.
Well, having just actually lived through this whole thing, and it's still going on, by the way. And I think, when the whole Ukraine-Russia war happened, overnight we, if I give an example from the last organization I was with, we had to substitute ingredients. So oil, like, sunflower oil that we had,
Hash browns.
into, a whole lot of products. So, I was a team, in my team, we were working, to find alternatives, to find options, that was not just going to be one change, but a change for a bit of time before we would then be able to hunt for that. Price of oil went through the roof. So when you're in a frying business, it's a little bit difficult, right? I think those kind of things, which sometimes you don't quite see coming, and it hasn't been just oil as one example. There have been many ingredients, many substitutions that companies are still reeling with. So it's meant a lot of change. It's meant, we had to work with the regulators like FSANS around label change and things like that, just to make sure that we were, critical. So it's brings almost that. How do you do the business of food when you have so much disruptions, when you have not just one crisis, but many poly crises happening as well? So it makes, yes, the world of food innovation and food product development across the supply chain very interesting, but relentless, because there is never a steady state. And I think that is probably the way that it's evolving now to where it probably was before the old times when people refer to that. Which was only a few years back, though.
Well, I think it was relatively steady, like last couple of years. Probably, I reckon, in reality, you can probably say since 2016, basically when Trump came in. Since then, we've had sort of a more unstable environment for commodities than the previous 20 years, which were quite stable other than droughts and whatnot. But geopolitically, it's become a lot more unstable in the last sort of.
And we're potentially about to head back into that Trump era again, maybe.
Again, as I'll put this out there, that Trump will be the next president.
I hope not. But
You're
anyway,
calling it, are you?
calling it now.
He called it the last time round as well and got it right. So, and you called the Brexit result. There was a
And
little string of major political calls you made in a row that were all pretty accurate when they entered.
all the elections since 2010 in the UK, Scotland, and Australia.
No wonder you're moderating this panel on the political
No,
discourse.
I'm not moderating it.
I think you're. I think you're a.
I'm on the panel.
Oh, you are on the
Yeah,
panel.
yeah,
Yeah,
yeah.
so.
What's did you say? Are you on two
I,
panels
well,
then? Is there?
actually, technically, I'm not on the panel because I'm here as Ag Watchers, whereas I'm on the panel as Episode Three, which
Episode
is
three.
our commercial serious side of the things.
When we can be
So there
serious.
will be no there'll be no laughter.
And no references to Scottish food innovation.
There'll be nothing. I'll just be there
Yeah.
professionally, diligently doing my market analysis role.
What are you presenting? Oh, you're on another panel as well, Angeline, is that right?
I
It's you're
am. I
on more
see
than one.
later in the afternoon, looks like I'm on a panel on the complexities of sustainable supply chains.
Another interesting one. So
With
are you there because you're Melbourne based, so are you there for the whole period of the conference, the few days, or are you just coming in for the one day to
No, I'll probably come in the first day. I think the program looks fantastic,
It is.
actually.
It's,
But
it looks really good. So
yeah.
yeah.
And also, you'll get to try and, well, meet different people and from all different walks of life, but also see some of the new innovations that are out there in the exhibit as well. There's a
Andrew might be
combat happening.
able to bring some haggis from our podcast sponsor Pacton Park, Andrew, to for
Who
Angeline to
are
taste.
food innovators also as
They
well.
are. Yeah, they are food innovators.
Maybe we could have a live sensory tasting and just
As
record
there could be, we
my
could.
reaction.
It would be, that would be a good idea, actually. We could probably get Pacton Park to fund that. But no, it is actually quite a good. Like I know that we're obviously working with Future Ag because we're presenting there. We're doing a presentation on markets as well, economic drivers of ag markets, on one of the stages.
I think it's May you live in interesting times or something was what you talked about, wasn't it?
Something like that. But we are, I think it's a good idea because I know it's a relatively small expo this time around, but it is actually free of charge to attend.
The expo part.
The expo, the conference is $100 or something, which is not exactly
It's good value.
and taxable. It's probably it looks like a decent thing. The only probably better one to go to is the Episode Three stroke Ag Watchers Commodity Retreat in New Caledonia.
Oh my
And
goodness.
so if it's a Warren Buffett style retreat stroke training course on
Very
commodity
select,
markets.
it's very select entry.
And I have priced it up actually with the Marriott in New Caledonia. So if anyone is actually interested, we mentioned that as a bit of a joke, but if anyone is actually interested in coming along, send us an email or drop us a line, and then we might actually do it in July, August, or September.
Oh,
New
wow.
Caledonia, New Caledonia, and then you were thinking about moving around the Pacific, so you might have to get some tips from Angeline about Fiji
Or
next time
thinking
around.
Fiji for next year.
Yeah.
And
Samoa.
I have spent some years in Samoa as well. I would recommend that.
FYI, as it's an educational program, it is fully tax deductible for farmers and food industry professionals.
Wow. Are you designing? Will you design the menu? Maybe it will be a Scottish theme in New Caledonia
Now
or
there's an
something. I
idea.
can
We
see
could
that
get
happening. That's an
we could
idea.
take we could bring old Caledonia to New Caledonia. No, it'll be Polynesian cuisine because I love fresh seafood.
And French
And French. Oh, and I
inspired.
love French food as well. French food
And
is.
maybe a little bit of Italian snuck in there.
A spag bol.
Pizza at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Deep fried. There we go. We can see now that it's starting to deteriorate into silliness, Andrew. So unless you've got other serious questions, frankly.
Nah, I think I'm covered.
Well, there we are.
So, well, thanks very much for coming on and providing some informative information to our listeners. I think it's an area we haven't really covered. We haven't really crossed into food all that many times, really, other than when we have Pat and Park on to talk about their
I think
innovations.
Given Angeline's experience, though, we've only just scratched the surface. So we might have a bit of a chin wag at the conference and then see if there's other podcasts we can focus in on a few other areas of that crossover between ag and food manufacturing and food innovation.
What we should do is we should actually have a podcast where we actually do some homework beforehand. All right. Right. This might sound unusual, but actually do some homework in advance of the podcast.
Are you
right?
crazy?
And we actually come with a pitch each. Each of us comes with a pitch.
Oh,
for
what?
New,
to Angeline and about a new and, food idea.
Yeah, that'd be good. Yeah. Mm.
Oh, that reminds me. I'm just some homework for me this afternoon is I'm a judge on the Hive Awards. Have you heard of that? It's the Hive Awards for food and drinks. I had a sneak look before. I can't reveal anything, but my goodness, the amount of innovation there is exciting. It's great to see what's
well,
happening.
Well, wait till you hear our pitches.
So I
actually gave somebody Simplot an idea. They never used it.
Oh, really?
I've got this really, really good recipe for white barbecue sauce. And it tastes absolutely fantastic. Like a barbecue sauce, but it's white. And you can put it on ribs or chicken, and it is just beautiful. I gave it to them, never used it. And white barbecue sauce is popular in the US, like in Alabama and Georgia. It's nice.
Maybe they sampled it in one of those rooms and didn't get the desired results. They just didn't want to let you down harshly.
I think it was just ignored. I think they assumed it was a Scottish thing.
They probably took it through a screener and said, N equals one. This is not going to fly.
There's a space for it in the marketplace. Right. Thank you, Angeline, for coming on. And we shall bump into, well, I'll see you on stage.
Awesome.
Definitely. See you at the conference. And we'll see you when you got nothing on.
Yeah. No worries. Ciao for now.
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye. See ya.